Hey, it's Hannah Baba, host of Cross Current. Just a couple of times a year, we ask for your support, and now's the time to do that. Make sure to contribute today to our fall membership campaign. Keep us strong. If you want to contribute, go to KALW.org and click donate. And thank you.
KALW.
I just want to pursue my dream, and I want to receive a phone call from Simon that said, Didi, let's do this.
An Oakland singer is competing for her big break.
It was so emotional. I didn't know that I would feel this way during the finals.
Today, how a nurse from San Quentin became a finalist for this season of America's Got Talent. Then, what does wilderness feel like, and is it the same for everyone?
Cultural norms have shaped how individuals might respond to a given scenario. Whether a particular kind of wilderness is refreshing or frightening.
The last episode of How Wild. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Tonight, the long-running competitive reality show America's Got Talent will be wrapping up their 19th season, and they'll be announcing the winner of their $1 million prize. One of the finalists hoping to win is Oakland singer Didi Simon. She's been performing for more than 20 years, but in her day-to-day, Didi spends her time caring for others. She's a nurse at San Quentin State Prison for inmates serving life sentences, and she looks after her mother, who has Alzheimer's. KALW's Janae Darden recently spoke with Didi Simon about how America's Got Talent may be able to make her musical dreams come true.
Didi Simon!
Hey!
Welcome! Hey! You and I, we both fellow Oakland girls.
Yes, we are. Yes.
Now, where'd you go to high school?
I went to Bishop O'Dowd. I went to Webster, St. Benedict, Bishop O'Dowd.
Okay. I went to St. Elizabeth High School.
Okay. All right. You all right?
We might have crossed paths. So I'm always happy to see some East Oakland representation because so much talent comes from where we grew up. And you have an incredible story. A lot of people who've been following the show know that you've worked in San Quentin for 19 years, right? You're a nurse. Really, really wild, incredible, interesting job. What else do you want people to know about you?
Along with working full time, I'm a full caregiver for my mother. And they were able to see her at the show with me. And you know, she's been here while I've gotten prepared for the show. And I just want to give a shout out to the care workers that helped me, like at the Alzheimer's services that helped me with my mother while I'm working in the daytime, as far as she's able to be at a center and interact. So, you know, having my mom on the set was really... It got kind of difficult sometimes because she didn't really understand what was going on.
And you take care of people, too, just in what you do as a nurse, as a caretaker to your mom. And I think, too, as a singer, that's even some form of care, right? Because your voice moves people, lifts people up.
Thank you.
And you definitely got people excited with your performance, definitely the final performance. And Judge Simon Cowell said something that I was also thinking the same thing when he said it, which was, he said your performance felt like a concert.
You know, my performance, it was a blur. It was so emotional. I didn't know that I would feel this way during the finals. It was so emotional. Right when I got on stage and heard my mom's voice in the back of me, and I was like, oh, I wasn't ready for this. I didn't prepare for that.
Yeah.
So it was very emotional. And I just remember the click, click, click in my ear, and it was time to go because we've been waiting for this moment for a long time.
And you sang Take Me to Church by the Irish artist Hozier, and it's a deep song with many meanings, including challenging homophobia in the church. And you gave it a very, very soulful rendition. Why that song?
Well, that's what the producer chose and asked me to sing. And, you know, I always talk about a door being closed and they can't get through it. And I've never been the reason for that door being closed. So when they asked me to do this song, I said, you know, I took the song, I looked at the video, read the lyrics, and, you know, I tried to figure out why would they want me to sing this song and what can I do? What can I do to bring more to this song? It was a challenge for me, not the song. It was a challenge for me to go do my homework and not just do a song that I've been singing all my life, like a Whitney or a Shaka or a Patty. It was something where I had to go do some homework. So they really stretched me.
Now, you've won big competitions.
Yes.
Including Amateur Night at the Apollo in 2023.
Yes.
If you can win Amateur Night at the Apollo, because the Apollo audience,
they don't play. The Apollo audience is something, it's a beast, okay? So yeah. I show up there and I'm from the West Coast and most of the acts on there are from the East Coast. So their people are all in the audience. So every time I come, I'm the underdog. I don't know anybody in the audience. Maybe a few people flew out to support me. It was like every competition, it was hard, you know, to overcome the audience. And eventually the audience became to be your people, your fans. That was, oh my God. You know, I tell singers that say, I can do that, go do it. You got to experience it.
And for those listeners who haven't seen Dee Dee, Dee Dee gets on the floor. Dee Dee not just standing up singing holding a mic. Dee Dee get on the floor. Dee Dee kick off her shoes. Dee Dee, Dee's like,
you know,
like that old school, the old school R&B soul singers. You know, I'm thinking like Patti LaBelle, you know, that kind of stuff. Kicking off the shoes while rolling on the floor. Dee Dee gets into it.
And that's the thing. See, back when Jodeci was always out there, you would see them. I love Patti kicking off the shoes. But I always wanted to, you know, be like, well, how come women can't perform like this and hump the ground and do all of this
stuff?
Yeah,
you do that.
So I'm like, I'm getting it in.
And, you know, that's Oakland, too. I see that, you know, being extra, you know, in
extra.
A good way. So, Dee Dee, so I understand that the winner of America's mm-hmm. Got Talent gets a $1 million cash prize.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just think, too, just winning a competition like this definitely amplifies you as an artist. So what would this prize mean for you?
Winning this money would do so much as far as I can go pursue my dream. I mean, in California, $1 million is not a lot no more, right. But it sure is a boost. And I told my, I want to pay all my friends' credit cards that flew out here to see me, you know, and rental cars they had to buy and days I want to pay their days they missed off of work calling in sick. I want to help the Alzheimer's center that my mom goes to so that, because they need some new things. And then after I take care of all those and settle all of that, then I just want to pursue my dream and I want to receive a phone call from Simon that said, Dee Dee, let's do this.
That was Oakland singer Dee Dee Simon speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. The winner of America's Got Talent will be announced tonight. Janae and Dee Dee spoke a lot more. You can find their whole conversation at KALW.org/crosscurrents. That interview was co-produced by Porfiria Rangel. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. For some some of us, the idea of wilderness means peace or adventure. But for others, it's a scary concept. Up next, we'll explore how history and culture shape our ideas of the great outdoors in an excerpt from the 7th episode of our new podcast, How Wild. The series is reported, produced, and hosted by KLW's Marissa Ortega Welch. Here's Marissa.
Your local public radio, Saturdays, 8 to midnight.
The thing about making a podcast about wilderness is you don't exactly have any time to go into wilderness while you're making it.
In half a mile, take exit 456 for Lucas Valley Road.
The big backpacking trip that my friend Holly and I normally take every year was postponed. In fact, we had a permit to hike the John Muir Trail at the end of July, but I had to cancel it because I was too busy making this show, which is how I ended up here by myself, at a much closer wilderness area to where I live, in Point Reyes National Seashore.
It is foggerino. It is foggy.
Point Reyes is about an hour's drive north of San Francisco. It's a triangle-shaped peninsula that's stuck to the coastline of Marin County. As I drive, the forest opens up to rolling grasslands that end in sandy cliffs at the ocean.
It's a bumpier road than I remember, and windier too.
It's a popular place to hike in the hills or walk along the beach, or kayak in Tamales Bay, which separates the peninsula from the mainland. Or just stop in the small towns to sample cheese from the local dairies here.
Oh, there's cows. Dairy of the year 2009.
That's the thing about Point Reyes. It's this interesting mix of agriculture and wilderness. Long before Point Reyes was a national park, people were ranching out here. It got commercial during the gold rush. Ranchers sold their dairy products to nearby San Francisco. In 1962, some of the ranchers sold their land to the Park Service, and the National Seashore was established. In exchange, the ranchers got leases to continue to operate. So as I drive out the road to my trailhead, I pass cattle grazing on the hillside and barns.
And there's fences paralleling the road. And on either side of the fence is a ranch.
But I also pass trailheads that head into Capital W Wilderness. In 1976, Congress created the Philip Burton Wilderness out here. If you look on a map, the outline of the wilderness is this very squiggly line that has to go out of its way to avoid roads and campgrounds and ranches. Unlike in the Sierra or Rockies, where you can travel for days without seeing a road, in Point Reyes Wilderness, you might start a hike that enters into wilderness and in a few miles get to a beach that you could otherwise drive to. I'm driving now to a section of wilderness at the northernmost tip of that Point Reyes Triangle.
Okay, so wait, so here's a cattle guard, and now instead of the fence being parallel to the road, there's a much taller fence perpendicular to the road. And this is the Tule Elk Fence.
One of the big draws for coming to this northern tip of the point is to see Tule Elk. They used to live all over the peninsula in huge herds, but as ranching took over, they were hunted out. In the 70s, elk were reintroduced to Tamales Point, but the Park Service built a fence to keep this elk herd and the cows separate.
This is the fence that keeps the elk from wandering off the tip of the point and into the rest of Point Reyes. And then here's a sign. Tule Elk Reserve, the collection of elk antlers is prohibited.
Both the elk fence and the ranches in Point Reyes are controversial. Some people think ranches have no place in national parks and that the elk fence should come down. Since the elk are essentially stuck on this side of the fence, with climate change making droughts more intense here, some of the elk's reliable water sources dried up, and the park got concerned. They put in water troughs, but of course, some people think this goes against the untrammeled and undeveloped requirements of wilderness. There's been a lot of press about this already, and I'm not going to dive into the debate, because that's not why I came out here today.
Okay, we're going to drive across this cattle gate and through the Tule Elk Fence.
The reason why I wanted to come to this place isn't because of the controversy. It's because I think Point Reyes serves as an interesting backdrop for questions about little W and big W wilderness.
Let's just pull over and see.
I hear something while I'm driving and decide to pull over and check it out.
It's foggy.
I can barely see the hill next to the road, but I hear something.
Oh, hell yeah. Hell yeah. It's elk bugling.
Okay, this feels wild. And it's surprising because usually Point Reyes doesn't feel like wilderness to me, even though it's capital W wilderness. This is How Wild, a podcast about wilderness, how it's changing, and what that says about us as humans. Episode 7, Wild Ideas. Part 1, Little W Wilderness. The parking lot for the Tomales Point Trailhead is pretty empty today.
Foggy day. Is it evening? Friday evening?
The whole vibe is putting me in a contemplative mood. Right at the trailhead, there's a historic ranch that was built in the 1850s. A bunch of white wooden structures cluster around each other. Most are boarded up. An old blacksmith shop, a schoolhouse, a giant milking barn.
On the side of the barn, someone wrote, "Free the elk."
The trail heads past the ranch and out the point.
And what I love about this trail is it's sort of like this catwalk that you're walking with the ocean on one side of you and Tomales Bay on the other. And then it looks like you're just walking out to the edge of the world as you're walking at this point. I can't see any of that right now, though, because it's so foggy, I can barely see ahead of me.
It's a stunning view when you can see it, and this is normally a very popular trail.
One good thing about being here on a foggy day is that I can talk to myself and not feel weird about it. I mean, not that weird.
What I want to talk to myself about today is, after all this discussion about the five qualities of wilderness character, what about the feeling of wilderness? Because even though this place is capital W, designated wilderness, it doesn't feel like wilderness to me. It doesn't have the same feeling as in the Sierra or the Gila, and I've been trying to figure out why that is. So I called up some people we've met to help me untangle this. First, I talked to historian Phoebe Young, who grew up in the Bay Area and knows Point Reyes really well.
You're not as remote. You don't feel as if you're as immersed in some kind of primeval setting. You're cognizant of this place was changed. And it may be beautiful. It may feel wide open. But it has a different quality to it because of that history and because there's evidence of that in the landscape.
It's not just the history, the old ranches. It's the fact that I'm never very far from a road here, never too long without cell service. I don't feel disconnected or unplugged here, even though it's beautiful. The same place where I can see whales breaching in the ocean, I can also see San Francisco on a clear day. Look, I have a friend who grew up coming here and thinks I'm ridiculous. She totally has a feeling of wilderness here. But my first experience of wilderness was in Yosemite. That's what's mapped onto my brain as wilderness. I hear land managers talk about this concept of rock and ice, like the high mountain peaks and glaciers of places like the Sierra Nevada, the Rocky Mountains. That's what's become the quintessential wilderness experience to me. But for some people, they feel the most in wilderness in the desert, out on the ocean, or on the Great Plains. The reason why I keep harping on this is that I want to think about wilderness as this ineffable but intrinsic quality. But the fact that it varies from person to person shows how much the idea of wilderness is constructed by history, by culture.
We can have a feeling of wilderness. It doesn't mean that that feeling is always positive or that it's the same for every person. What is it now versus what it was for the Puritans, for Emerson, for Muir, for African Americans who were trying to access these spaces, you know, in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s, you know, for families that were overrunning campgrounds in the 50s and 60s.
So many things shape how we experience the feeling of wilderness, how old we are, where we grew up, who we grew up with, and how. And they come into play when we talk about the mental health benefits of being in nature. There's a lot of research being done on this right now, what Phoebe calls the nature cure. There's something called the three-day effect. Neuroscientists have actually studied people's brains and seen that after 3 days in nature, like on a rafting or camping trip, away from all the pressures of daily life, people become better at problem solving and better at paying attention. There's also research done on the feeling of awe, A-W-E, the awe or wow feeling you get when you go to the top of a mountain and see a beautiful view or watch a sunset over the ocean. Having a feeling of awe is shown to reduce people's stress, lift their moods, and even make people feel more connected to each other. I know that feeling well, getting to the top of a mountain pass and seeing the view in every direction. But Phoebe says to be careful about making these universal assumptions about how nature is beneficial for people.
Let me first say that I won't deny that being outdoors, nature, wilderness can have mental health benefits. I certainly benefit from it. But I also know who I am. I'm a middle-class white woman who lives in Boulder, Colorado. This is part of my cultural norms, my training, how I was taught to feel comfortable in these spaces.
Phoebe says when she started to see these research papers and headlines about the mental health benefits of nature, it gave her pause.
It started to kind of raise the hairs up on my arm. Something seemed a little odd to me, mostly about the universality of the claim.
Not everyone reacts the same to nature.
Cultural norms from a century ago still have legacies in the way we interact in the outdoors today. Those cultural norms have shaped how individuals might respond to a given scenario, whether a particular kind of wilderness is refreshing or frightening.
That was an excerpt from the last episode of How Wild, a series produced by KALW's Marissa Ortega Welch. It was made with support from California Humanities and distributed as a podcast by NPR. We've been airing excerpts here on Cross Currents, but you can find a link to the entire episode and the whole series at klw.org/crosscurrents. And if you like what you heard and want to support a place that produces a series like How Wild, then consider supporting us during our fall membership campaign. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.